Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What do your social networking habits reveal about your life, and how might they be used for or against you in a legal matter? Surveys show we're using nearly a fifth of our online time these days interacting on sites like Facebook, Twitter, MySpace, Foursquare, and Google+. And with every photo posted or tagged, every comment made or liked, and every check-in at a physical location, we're leaving behind an ever more detailed and possibly indelible sketch of our personal lives that may or may not reflect positively on who we are. John G. Browning is an attorney and legal journalist based in Dallas. He writes about the legal and ethical ramifications of all this friending and posting and tweeting in his new book, The Lawyer's Guide to Social Networking, Understanding Social Media's Impact on the Law. John, welcome to Think.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You know, it's amazing to think that as recently as a decade ago, except for those of us who had the time and energy to make our own websites, we weren't really putting anything out there on the web. We were maybe sending email. We were going to sites. Now we have, 70-year-old people posting multiple times a day about their lives. At what point did you start to recognize that this was going to be a very major issue in the world of law?
Well, actually, I'm not a techie by, upbringing or any other way. Really, this is just an outgrowth of what I do as a trial lawyer. What we used to rely upon to help evaluate an adversary in a lawsuit, say a personal injury plaintiff. In the old days, you might have retained a private investigator and done some surveillance so that you saw the person wearing the cervical collar who'd take it off and play a pickup game of basketball or engage in some other strenuous activities really wasn't as injured as he or she claimed to be. Nowadays, the plaintiffs are doing it for us. They're posting things online, their vacation photos, their hobbies and interests, and they're actually giving the other side information, putting the ammunition in our gun.
Now, can you subpoena a password or demand to have access to somebody's online communication?
A number of courts have actually ordered that, and you can request it in discovery, in formal discovery, from the other side, provided that you have, a reasonable basis. Mm-hmm. In some cases where a person has said, oh, I'm in constant pain and I never go outside, and you look at the publicly viewable photos on her Facebook page, and she's outside on the lawn and she's smiling.
Uh-huh. Well, that skydiving and whatever else.
Exactly. Yeah. And there may very well be more. And so that gives you some basis to say, hey, judge, I'd like to, more of a peek under the tent.
Mm-hmm. I was really astonished to read how many people don't pay much attention to privacy policies. If we don't protect ourselves, is it just let the buyer beware?
Well, I ask my law students, I teach over at SMU Law School, and I ask them, is it ignorance or is it apathy? And one of them said, I don't know and I don't care. I think part of it is this tendency, especially among, the Gen Y and millennials, to live an increasingly large part of their lives online, and they simply, don't care. But to take the other side, there have been some surveys done. CareerBuilder.com did one that questioned social media users about their knowledge about the privacy options and restrictions, and a shockingly high percentage of them were simply unaware of not only what their options were, but how to go about implementing them.
Of course, sites like Facebook have Facebook in particular has a particularly notorious evanescent sort of set of privacy restrictions that will change without really giving much notice, and people who had said they wouldn't share something suddenly are sharing it unless they go back in and say that. Do laws need to be amended at some point to restrict that sort of activity by the companies that are providing these services?
Well, the problem is that there's a whole body of federal statutes that apply to internet service providers and encompassing social media sites. We have a thing called the Stored Communications Act, which applies to electronically stored information. And theoretically, it's supposed to protect certain privacy concerns there. Unfortunately, the Stored Communications Act was enacted back in 1986 before you know, personal computing became what it is today, before the advent of social media. Of course, you know, we had MySpace founded in 2003, Facebook founded in 2004. They're relatively recent phenomena that, you know, it's a truism that the law simply does not keep up with the pace of technology.
So let's talk about some of the ways that these things have been used in particular kinds of cases. It's not surprising at all that family lawyers dealing with divorce cases were some of the first people to decide they might want to look at this.
Absolutely. It's been so incredibly widespread in the family law arena. There was a survey done last year by the American Academy of Matrimonial Lawyers, and 81% reported having used evidence from social networking sites in their cases. Just an incredible percentage. I mean, of course, you know, there are those who also tell you that getting on social media sites, looking up old flames or, you know, childhood sweethearts and things like that is what precipitates some of the divorces in the first place.
It's interesting, though, because you could sort of get on a site and look for somebody and have no intention of doing anything wrong. But then, you know, 3 years later, when your marriage has fallen apart, that can incriminate you.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. People's you don't need to look much further than the Casey Anthony trial. Mm-hmm. You know, just the search terms that you put in can and will be used against you in a court of law. You know, this has cropped up in a number of cases around the country. And, yeah, you know, just the very act of looking online, in some cases, it's precipitated some very tragic occurrences. A couple of homicides have taken place because of someone changing their relationship status from, married or you know, in a relationship to single. And, you know, in at least one instance, we had a murder in New York that escalated was a result of an argument over, I think, something as trivial as $20 that was loaned to buy baby food and baby diapers. And it slowly escalated between the two young women to the point where, you know, one went over to the other's apartment and stabbed her.
So do the things that we say and do online carry more weight in front of a jury than, say, a witness account? So, for example, if I'm furious one day at having no money and I say, God, I just wish I could rob a bank, to an acquaintance, that person could very well be called up to testify after I'm accused of robbing a bank. Would that somehow be less convincing or less important than if I had written that as my Facebook status, like, boy, I'm going to hit that Chase Bank next Tuesday?
Well, it's funny because in Houston there was that very same instance with a couple of tellers implicated in taking part in and helping plan a bank robbery, where they were writing about it online on their Facebook page, both before and then after, kind of celebrating what happened. But I think, like anything else, Chris, it depends on context. Mm-hmm. You know, I've tried cases for 22 years, and I can tell you a little bit about what juries do and don't like. And I can tell you that if you've taken a position that no, things were one way, and then you are impeached with statements that you've made in any forum, you know, whether it's in an online forum or whether it's in a document that's suddenly unveiled and, you know, shared with the jury, they tend to that damages your credibility, and, you know, you erode their trust.
Talk about alibis here, because we have had people who have been convicted based on things they've done on social media. And we've also had at least a couple of people acquitted because they could prove they were somewhere else.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, I was contacted by the New York Times after, one of the really the first social media alibi, the Facebook alibi, where a young man in New York was a suspect in an armed robbery. And, of course, you know, he insisted, hey, I was at home at the time. I've got, you know, my mom and other relatives attesting to this. And finally, he, you know, said, look, you know, what I was doing at the time, I was on Facebook communicating with my then pregnant girlfriend. And I was, you know, even making a joke on my Facebook page because some relatives had gone out for pancakes and hadn't brought me any. And so, you know, he made a joking comment and they said, well, you know, to take you at your word is one thing, but it's another to actually look at the server records for Facebook. Look at your logon time. Look at, you know, does it match the ISP address, the Internet Protocol address, and verify that, yes, indeed, you were online. And so we have something more than just one person's testimony to go by.
Of course, the tricky thing about that is that he could have said to his brother, hey, jump online for me. I'm going to go commit this armed robbery and you talk to my girlfriend.
Yeah. And that's one of the criticisms is, you know, well, couldn't someone have logged in remotely? Well, first of all, you know, and they're tech people who are far more qualified than I am to talk about this, there are certain trails that you, mm-hmm. you leave when you do something like that. When you're logging on remotely or doing something from, say, a smartphone, you know, at another location. The second thing is that this was not simply looking at anything in isolation or in a vacuum. You had corroborating testimony, eyewitness testimony. You had third-party corroboration in the form of the, you know, the server records. Mm-hmm. And so it wasn't as if the police and the prosecution just had to take one aspect of this. They were able to take it in total.
So talk about the assumptions that can be made about a person based on, and you mentioned Casey Anthony, on internet searches, because you can make a lot of assumptions about what someone's thinking about. It could also be that someone's just curious about something. I'm interested in how attorneys defend people who are accused and sort of made to seem guilty based on evidence that looks incriminating but may simply reflect curiosity.
Well, unfortunately, some attorneys haven't done a great job of doing that because they've simply adopted either at their client's insistence or their own theorizing that we'll simply just deny it. You know, that's not me. You know, it brings to mind the Austin Powers, you know, scene. That's not me, baby. You know,
it's unlikely to work.
Exactly. And what a number of courts have talked about is, well, we're not just looking at one thing or another. The unique thing about social media sites is that these profiles allow for a tremendous amount of individualization. Mm-hmm. So it's one thing to say, oh, well, someone created some online presence for me and, you know, they had some basic information. It's another to take a look at a site that has, you know, person's nicknames and, you know, their particular hobbies and interests and tastes in music and movies and all these little pieces of individualizing information that help link it to that particular person.
I'm interested in the implications for employment law, because there have been cases of bosses checking up on their employees outside of work time based on what they post.
Oh, absolutely. And really, there are so many aspects in which this is coming to light. And it's something that is certainly not escaping the attention of the federal government. The National Labor Relations Board has started to look into whether or not an employer who takes action based upon someone, you know, commenting about work or work conditions on a social media site, whether or not that employer is out of line by trying to violate federal law and prevent someone from engaging in what's called concerted activity. We've had it in the context of people making claims that, you know, were able to contradict, for example, you know, sexual harassment claims. When someone is claiming that they were shocked at particular things on a site, you can look and find that maybe they weren't so shocked, judging by what was on their Facebook page.
John G. Browning is my guest. He's a Dallas attorney and legal journalist. His new book is called The Lawyer's Guide to Social Networking: Understanding Social Media's Impact on the Law.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
I'm Chris Boyd. You're listening to an archive edition of Think. We're speaking this hour with Dallas attorney and legal journalist John G. Browning, whose new book is called The Lawyer's Guide to Social Networking, Understanding Social Media's Impact on the Law. I want to go back, John, to this employer thing, because let's say 15 years ago, a guy has a bad day at work. He goes out for a beer with a buddy and he says, I can't stand those jerks at the place I work, and we make nothing but junk. And it would have probably been forgotten by the end of the evening. Now, if he's sitting at his computer, drinking a beer, having the same conversation with the same friend, this could get him fired.
It could. It could. A number of companies have what are called social media policies, where for a number of reasons, you know, they advise their employees, hey, you know, we all know we live in an online world now, and we want you to be careful what you say, including, you know, in an online forum. And there are some good reasons for this. You know, you don't want someone disparaging the company. You don't want someone bad-mouthing competitors even. You don't want someone sharing your intellectual property or confidential information by someone going on a Facebook page and saying, hey, I'm working on this big new project at TI. Mm-hmm. You know, let me tell you all about it. You know, there's some valid reasons why companies do that. And where we get into a little bit more of a gray area is are those policies sometimes too broad? And is the grousing at the digital water cooler, so to speak, you know, something that really is a violation of that policy? So I think it all comes down to, you know, an employer giving you some fair warning. Don't do this. We consider this wrong. Mm-hmm. Don't badmouth us. And companies ranging from restaurant chains to airlines have had to fire people because of saying things that portray the company in a bad light or otherwise violate that sort of policy.
I think most people, even if they disagree, can understand the reasons why companies would do that. I've also heard cases of, say, a public school principal saying to teachers, you will not friend any students, you will not friend parents of your students. Suddenly, people are interfering in places that seem to not be appropriate.
Well, it's very true. In fact, Missouri just passed a law banning teachers from friending students. And one of the school teachers has already filed suit challenging the law as unconstitutional because, as it's worded, she's a teacher. She has a child who's a student. Mm-hmm. Can you not communicate with your own kid on Facebook in that sort of instance? You know, or is that statute overreaching? So, you know, there are some limits to it, and there are some very valid concerns. You know, we've had in the school context, we've had courts at very high levels look at whether or not something that a child does, even, you know, setting up a Facebook profile that makes fun of a teacher or an administrator, if they're doing that off campus, if they're not disrupting or causing, you know, some sort of violence within the school environment, are they engaging in protected free speech? And a number of courts have come down and said precisely that, that when it's off campus like that, you know, you're entitled. And there are a number of states that have statutes protecting employees. You know, if you want to engage in political discussions, discussions about union activity, there are a number of states that have separate statutes that protect those very same things, regardless of where you're doing it.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to the phones now. First, we'll speak with Harold in Denton. Hi, Harold.
Yes. Good show. I have a question for counsel.
Let me stop by saying just a moment. We're not going to have John give any legal advice. Just so you know, I want to let you know that.
Well, I understand.
I don't want to have to send you a bill.
Recently, asked about my Facebook site by one of my graduate students. I pointed out that, of course, he knew perfectly well that I did not have a Facebook site. Whereupon he showed me the Facebook site with a picture of me, Nick. No doubt from the department website, and perhaps more disturbing, quotes attributed to me which were incorrect. What I would like to know is how to get that thing shut down.
Wow, that's a tough problem.
Yeah, and there are some legal avenues available to Harold. First of all, you should know that as of September 2009, Texas made it a violation of the penal code. It's a crime to create a false online persona. So when someone purports to be you and creates a fake Facebook profile of you, they're actually committing a crime. That's number one. Two, you can actually go directly, and you don't need a lawyer necessarily. We'd love it if you did hire a lawyer. It's good for business. But you can go directly to Facebook. If you look online, there are there's contact information for an administrator there at Facebook. You can point out that, number one, that's not you, and that whoever has created that profile has violated the terms of use, terms and conditions of use that Facebook themselves set up. I mean, one of the things that Facebook requires is that you register when you create an account and you vouch for the fact that you are you when you're doing that. When someone has done that in a false way, and I've actually communicated with Facebook and had them take down sites like this, you know, you're pointing out that, hey, they're violating your own rules, Facebook. And you can get that site taken down pretty quickly. Now, as to what other, you know, legal damage may have been done, that's, you know, that's up for speculation. But there are ways that you can combat that.
So you can get things taken down. I imagine it's much harder to catch the person responsible.
It is because of a certain sense of anonymity mm-hmm. that you know, is pervasive on the internet. And again, going back to our constitutional discussion, there are some valid reasons why someone, you know, might be entitled to a certain degree of anonymity online. But there are limitations to that. And when someone is engaging in something that may defame someone else or is committing a crime online, certainly that's beyond the usual protected forms of free speech.
Is there legal recourse for things that are not necessarily false representations and they're not necessarily defamatory, but they're just embarrassing? If someone puts a picture up of me and it looks like I have a double chin and I just want that thing down, I'm just out of luck?
Well, you might be. You might be. Now, you know, there are a number of online sites, consumer review sites, for example, like Yelp or others, where unhappy businesses who have been slammed by someone writing in, oh, you know, don't buy from this, you know, particular business. They did a lousy job with this, or I had this horrible experience. There is a certain amount of protected opinion. When you're sharing your opinion about someone's goods or services, that's going to be okay. We also have a certain amount of protection in simply telling the truth. Mm-hmm. You know, truth is an absolute defense to that. You know, over in England, they didn't want to they banned certain photos of Julia Roberts because they'd been extensively airbrushed and it wasn't an accurate portrayal. Some people may be unhappy with a portrayal that's a little too accurate.
Mm-hmm. It makes me think of the Michelle Bachmann case, which is a kind of a different issue, so we won't get into it. But yeah. There's that question of what you should and should not represent in media.
Right.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Willa in Dallas. Hi, Willa.
Hi. This is Willa from Dallas, and I had a comment, kind of a question. You've addressed the legal issues about an employer kind of looking up something about an employee, but having been in the industry of working for employment agencies and for HR departments, I know that it is becoming a little bit more widespread that departments like this and agencies are using social network sites to screen individuals that are being considered for hire. So what can one do about that if you find out that that's actually the reason you didn't get the job? Or if you're working in that department, what should one do?
Well, there are a couple of things. First of all, there, of course, employers, as you point out, have been doing this on largely an informal basis for quite some time. They're increasingly becoming more and more formal about doing it to the point of using outside services, ones that have been accredited and vetted by the appropriate federal government authorities, a lot like credit reporting agencies. And in fact, one in particular just earlier this summer got formal approval from the government to do social media background checks. And of course, a company has to let you know, just like they have to let you know they're going to do a check into your credit history. There's you know, a form that you have to sign, and they have to let you know, hey, we're going to be doing this. So number one, something like that probably is not going to be done without your knowledge, and that gives you perhaps a little bit of advance notice that, hey, maybe those photos from spring break in Cancun back in the day are really not appropriate to have up on your site. That's certainly one thing. But some employers have also taken kind of an approach that's in the other direction. They've taken a "we don't want to know, we're not going to look," sort of a Sergeant Schultz type of approach.
I
know
nothing.
and there are some reasons for that. For example, if you do a pre-screening of a candidate, even though you didn't ask any of those forbidden questions about the person's background.
Race or sexual orientation or religion or
sure.
whether or not they have kids, something like that.
Exactly. You may go on the site and see, for example, an example I give to my students, you go on there and a person has her baby shower invitation on her Facebook page. Well, you didn't ask her if she was pregnant. She didn't appear pregnant. But let's say you make a decision for whatever reason not to hire that candidate. She may come back later if she's aware that you've looked at that and said, oh, well, you didn't hire me because you knew I was pregnant. Hmm. And that's a violation of federal law. Now, that may or may not have been the reason, but all of a sudden now you've got to deal with that lawsuit as an employer.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have an email here from Jim in Fort Worth who wants to know whether you would agree with this statement. Anytime you are on the internet, you should never expect any level of privacy.
Well, there are a number of federal courts that have said that very same thing. One federal judge, in looking at a case in which someone was contesting whether or not, the other side should be allowed to look at their social media profiles, said, you don't go on Facebook to engage in a soliloquy. By its very nature, it's all about sharing. By its very nature, you're sharing information with somebody and potentially many somebodies. And so, a number of judges have said you really don't have an expectation of privacy.
On the other hand, and this is not so much a social media thing as an internet search issue, but if going back to Casey Anthony again, had she gone to the library and walked through the stacks and pulled books and not checked anything out, no one would ever know. But the fact that she did these things online made them admissible in court.
Oh, for the days of the Dewey Decimal System and the card catalog. I kind of miss those days sometimes because there was that anonymity. Back when the Supreme Court Justice nominee Robert Bork was up during the hearings for, potential confirmation. It turned out to be unsuccessful. They were looking at what videos he had rented. And that led to a federal law about the privacy of people looking at your video rental records. So, our privacy is disappearing, in bits and pieces over the years.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Linda in Dallas. Hello, Linda.
Hi. Yes, hello. My name is Linda. I'm from Dallas, and I just had a question about pictures of minors being posted on things like Facebook and things like that. My son actually spent some time with his grandmother, and she took some pictures of them over the summer. And those have now gone on to other relatives, people that aren't relatives, and now, I'm seeing them, and I'm thinking, how did they get these pictures of my child? And once they're up there on someone else's page, how do I get them off?
Well, it's kind of like unringing a bell or putting the toothpaste back in the tube, I'm afraid. People should probably be cognizant of and careful to use privacy restrictions and settings on any social media site that they're on. And virtually all of them have restrictions where you can designate who can view what, and including family photos and things like that. And I've seen that sort of situation before. In one case, a Texas judge was wondering about someone who had visited her profile and seen pictures of her family and vacation photos. And ultimately, when the name seemed just a little too eerily familiar, she looked back in the records, and it was someone she had put in prison.
Hmm.
So it can be pretty scary about who's looking online.
Well, along that same line, a lot of social media sites encourage you to physically check in at places. And in some cases, if you don't turn it off, they'll automatically do this and they'll sort of make a record of where you are. I'm curious about your sense of how that will affect the law. And also the announcement a couple of months ago that the people at Apple had kept iPhone records, or maybe it was AT&T, stored for people's physical locations over a matter of months.
Yeah, that's scary. That's scary to me as a consumer. It's scary to me as a lawyer that degree of invasion of one's privacy takes place. It's one reason why I've never been too enamored of, you know, sites like Foursquare and, mm-hmm. and other ones. You might as well call them pleaserobme.com. You know, I'm not going to tell
not
you.
Home.
Yeah, I'm not going to tell you. I'm on vacation, you know, and I'm not home and everything else. I'm frankly not going to make it any easier for you than it may already be. And so I really question the wisdom of people who are feel compelled, you know, to give their geographical location at all times.
So do you think, though, that we at some point – what always scares me about that is that even without being a criminal suspect of any kind, people can perform surveillance and governments can go in there and get those records without necessarily having had a lot of probable cause, right?
Yeah, and it's actually kind of a hot topic right now in legal circles about whether or not it's unreasonable under the Fourth Amendment, unreasonable search and seizure – for police to do searches of your cell phone. If mm-hmm. you're stopped and taken into custody, that's one thing. But should they be allowed without a warrant from a court to go further than that and look at what information may be residing on your smartphone?
So is your drug dealer on your list of contacts, something like that?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Something that may tend to incriminate you. And, of course, we have constitutional rights preventing us from or protecting us from doing that. And there are a couple of states that have looked at it and they've gone in opposite directions. It's probably at some point going to go up to the U.S. Supreme Court.
So they said it's not unreasonable.
Some courts have. Some courts have said the exact opposite.
John G. Browning is my guest. He's a Dallas attorney and legal journalist and author of the new book, The Lawyer's Guide to Social Networking, Understanding Social Media's Impact on the Law.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can study a variety of topics such as creative writing, human rights, and the arts. More at smu.edu/MLS.
Listening to an archive edition of Think. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with legal journalist and attorney John G. Browning, author of The Lawyer's Guide to Social Networking, Understanding Social Media's Impact on the Law. John, what have we learned from the relatively new realm of cases saying that people were using social media to bully someone and that it's had these really horrible effects on people's lives? Are there lessons to be taken away from people who, if nothing else, want to protect themselves from being victimized?
Well, cyberbullying really has swept across the country in terms of a concern, and a number of states have enacted their own versions of statutes, some of which can cover an incredibly broad range of behavior. And so there are some dangers in terms of, you know, are we overreaching a little bit with that? But then you look at the very valid concern, you know, concerns like the Prince case in Massachusetts, or, I'm a Rutgers alum, so, you know, the Tyler Clementi case in the Rutgers student who committed suicide.
After his roommate said publicly that he was gay.
Well, and actually had a webcam set up to capture footage of him engaging in relations with another man.
To humiliate him.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And although this is still alleged and hasn't, you know, been proven yet, supposedly streaming it to other third parties. Hmm. And so, you know, it's a very real concern simply because of the traumatic effects it can wreak on someone's life. But we have to figure out where the lines have to be drawn. And right now they're pretty blurry.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Steve in Dallas. Hi, Steve.
Hi, how you doing?
Great, thanks.
I'm glad you got the lawyer on today because I was I'm thinking about starting a class action lawsuit against the state of Texas. And here's why. To get a driver's license renewal, the state of Texas is now demanding that you give up your Social Security number. From my understanding, that's against some federal laws. And when asked, why are you doing this? They say, well, we need it as a password for you to get on our website.
You know, that takes us a little off topic, actually, Steve. So I'm gonna let that one go, and maybe at some point in the future we can talk to somebody from the DMV and address that question. But I do thank you for your call. Let's go next instead to Alan in Bedford. Hello, Alan.
Yes, this is Alan.
Hi.
Thank you. Yeah, my question is this: my ex recently remarried. And the guy that she married, even though he's a pilot, he's very erratic in his behavior. And a couple of months ago, he sent me a series of text messaging, which are vile, vulgar, and threatening. And he's also done a couple of strange things to her children. We have a son together, six. But to the 12-year-old, for instance, he slapped her once and that sort of thing. But I'm ready to get essentially legally medieval on him. And I want to know these text messaging that he sent me, which I've all saved, of course. Can they be used as a preponderance of evidence, so to speak, about this guy's stability? Do emails have any weight? Actually, it was texting.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that.
Sure. Text messages and emails, they pop up in court all the time. Mm-hmm. Now, you have to have them in what we refer to as a legally admissible form. They have to be authenticated. If he's the recipient of these, he can say, I received these on the following dates. This is the circumstance behind this. And another way of getting that in a admissible form would be trying to contact the provider, like Verizon or whoever the provider would be, and say, hey, I need to get these records. They're, evidence in court, and you can actually subpoena records. Now, they'll probably notify the holder of the account, the sender. You can actually, if they're recorded by your receiving service provider, then you can also get it directly from yours. But one way or another, you need to have them in some form in which they're going to be legally admissible. But they can be used as evidence.
So we've talked about the sort of emerging issues and questions with a lot of these technologies. Your sense is that for the most part, we don't need an entirely new set of rules and ethical guidelines and laws to govern these things. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. And I guess I said earlier that the law doesn't keep pace with technology, and so there's the temptation. Well, why don't we just simply enact new laws to address these new forms of technology? And the problem is we would be enacting laws on a very regular basis. I mean, anyone who owns any piece of technology equipment, whether it's a smartphone or a laptop, knows that it's obsolete in a shockingly short period of time after you get it. But really, it's simply another avenue of communication. And so the overarching rules, whether they're ethical rules that involve lawyers and how they communicate with third parties and are not allowed to misrepresent who they are or to communicate with someone who is represented by an attorney already, really there's a way to find and to fit this form of communication within what already exists.
Do you have kids? Do you mind if I ask?
No, I have five four-legged kids.
Okay.
I'd love to count them as dependents.
Well, you do have students at SMU. I'm curious about the advice that you give them, if at all, about how to conduct themselves online.
Well, there was a study done right around the time that I was teaching this past semester, and I had a number of third-year law students who were set to take the bar exam this summer and who did, and hopefully all of them passed. They'll find out in November. But they were asked by one of the bar review services a questionnaire, a survey, if you will, about their online activities. And a shockingly high number of people responding to this nationally really didn't care about what was on their online profile. And it's a little shocking because one part of becoming a lawyer is there's a character and fitness examination that's done by the Board of Bar Examiners in whatever state. And Florida recently became the first state to say, you know, we're going to look at social media profiles of applicants. We want to know that you're not doing things like advocating the overthrow of the United States and engaging in terroristic activities and doing things like that, or that you're not displaying activities that would give us pause about licensing you to become a lawyer.
Which is interesting in a way, because I'm guessing that you have known effective attorneys who are alcoholics or who on their own time visit strip clubs or who do any number of things that, that other people might consider reprehensible or not ideal, but that don't affect their performance at work.
Oh, sure. That's absolutely true. But at the same time, you know, organizations that are administering and overseeing things like professional licensure have an obligation to the public. Mm-hmm. You know, I served on the State Bar's grievance committee for 6 years, and we have a responsibility to protect the public from lawyers who may be engaging in activity that could deceive, mislead, and hurt members of the public. So if you have a clue from some thing that someone has posted online about problems that they have, certainly you want, among other reasons, you want to get that person help and you want to steer them in the right direction. But you also want to prevent harm to the public.
So it's another tool of due diligence.
Absolutely.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to James in Dallas. Hi, James.
Hi. Yes, I'd like to ask the attorney. I work for a very large airline that's based here in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, which implemented a really all-encompassing social media policy requiring that employees not talk bad or, you know, disparage the company or talk bad about any of its supervisory personnel in any way. And just after that policy was implemented, there was a case that you're probably familiar with. I believe it was in Connecticut, ironically by another firm whose initials were AMR, I believe it was American Medical Response or some sort of ambulance company. And I think that the National Labor Relations Board, you know, came down with a really substantial and precedent-setting ruling saying that no employer could restrict an employee from engaging in social media discussions or online bulletin boards regarding supervisors' behavior, anything to do with pay, work rules, labor negotiations, and that sort of thing. My question to you is, my employer never came out and rescinded this all-encompassing social media policy, and in fact, the legal department was completely silent on the issue. So I'm wondering, you know, what can be done to basically require my employer to acknowledge this ruling and, you know, have them come forth and state that they are going to adhere to the ruling of the National Labor Relations Board.
Any thoughts, John?
Sure. Let me just correct the caller very quickly on a couple of things. One, that complaint involving the ambulance company in Connecticut, AMR, American Medical Response, wasn't an actual ruling, so it doesn't have any precedential value. What was significant about it and groundbreaking is it was the first time that the National Labor Relations Board had weighed in on the subject of a social media policy supposedly being too broad and overreaching. And in that case, it was actually an employee who may have been commenting upon a patient's confidentially protected condition online, in addition to bad-mouthing the company. What happened in the AMR case was they initiated this complaint, but before there was any actual ruling, the two sides agreed on a settlement. And the terms of the settlement were not completely disclosed, but I can tell you that they involve the company agreeing to narrow their social media policy somewhat. Now, I can't tell you if that was actually done or not. And I also can't tell you if a caller, if your employer's social media policy, without looking at it, is overly broad or not. What's going to have to happen if you, you know, need to bring that to the attention of some federal labor authorities is an incident in which there's some disciplinary action taken related to some social media activities by someone, and whether or not that was justified. And I can tell you that the NLRB has – they seem to be very aggressive in early on in the past year, but then they've – in three recent decisions, one of which involved Walmart, they've kind of backed off a little bit, and they've realized, you know, not everything that an employee posts on Facebook is necessarily an activity with coworkers. Mm-hmm. In some cases – you know, no coworkers were even involved or responded to the Facebook posting in question.
And if you haven't friended anybody at work and you say something about work and you haven't given them access to that personal information, is there a reason to believe that that's a privileged communication?
Well, it wouldn't necessarily be privileged because, you know, you're making it on Facebook and who knows how it might wind up in an employer's hands. But employers have gotten in trouble in the past for looking at something that they did not and were not supposed to have access to. In a case last year in New Jersey, a restaurant chain wasn't too happy when they found out that some of the staff, I think our bartender and hostess set this up as kind of a gripe site, but it was password protected.
Mm-hmm.
And online in this protected forum, they were grousing about, you know, the decor of the restaurant, the quality of the food, the customers, and poor tipping. You know, they had bad things to say about management. It was your typical, you know, sort of digital water cooler, if you will.
Yeah.
But it was password protected. The employers, some management, got a hold of, supposedly did a little arm twisting of one of the other hostesses, got access to it, and then promptly fired the people who were behind it. The people who were fired filed a lawsuit alleging, among other things, invasion of privacy and violation of the state and federal anti-wiretapping statutes. You weren't supposed to go looking at that. It was password protected, and you used improper means to find out. And they won.
Hmm. What are your, in your mind, the most tantalizing unresolved issues with all this?
Wow. Well, you know, there are a couple of things. We're seeing increasing use of social media in all kinds of ways, including procedurally. There have been several countries that have allowed people to be served with process, served with legal papers via a social media site.
Wow.
Now, we don't have that yet in the United States, but we do have certain rules. Virtually every state, including Texas, has rules that allow for a form of alternate service. And I think the day is not too far off when, you know, someone may get legal papers via Facebook.
John Browning is an attorney and legal journalist based in Dallas. His new book is called The Lawyer's Guide to Social Networking, Understanding Social Media's Impact on the Law. John, it's been a fascinating hour. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.